Well, hey, this is your old friend Bill. Whenever I find myself in Davis, I'm busy putting the fun in fundraising. But when I'm not, I always listen to KDVS 90.3 FM. And you should too. Go Aggies!
This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Welcome to the program. I thought we'd start out with a bit of Christmas cheer, a story from Dallas, Texas. A man named Matt Boswell has that holiday spirit down there in the Lone Star State. After doing some Christmas shopping last week, he noticed someone messing around the back of his pickup truck outside a shopping center. He came out of the mall, yelled at him, but watched as the man snatched a couple of plastic bags from his truck and leaped into a waiting car and flee. Now, Matt decided that he wouldn't give chase and he wouldn't call the police. The reason? The company that he owns is a pet waste removal firm. They specialize in removing dog doo off of lawns, and what apparently the thief made off with was 25 pounds of leftovers from Texas lawns in the Irving and North Dallas area. "It's pretty obvious what we do," said Mr. Boswell. "We scoop poop." He added that if the guys in the black four-door sedan want some more, we have plenty more where that came from. And last week, Sacramento held the 20th California International Marathon. I noticed in the B that an 80-year-old Helen Klein of Rancho Cordova, at age 80, completed the 26-mile course in 4 hours, 31 minutes, shattering the old mark of 5 hours and 10 minutes, I guess, for octogenarians. Holy mackerel. In a similar story, another event that's held for charity here, that actually has impacted on our show a little bit, the 7th annual ambulance chase was held also this last week. The event is co-sponsored both by the McGeorge School of Law and the King Law School here at UCD. It's sad because, I guess while participating in the race, our own legal eagle, Steve Alexander, sprained his ankle. It's too bad. Apparently, the ambulance, which sets the pace, stopped a little bit abruptly at one intersection and caused Steve to ram into its rear end. Yeah, Steve was supposed to appear on this program, but unfortunately, this injury explains why he won't be able to make it and why he hasn't even called us. But it's quite an event. I guess the ambulance chase originated in the old Dachshund races that used to take place at UCD during picnic day, and some of the law students over at King thought, hey, why not? We can do this too. Well, and speaking of ankle trouble, we thought we'd take up where we left off last week in some of these Only in America stories. And we told you the story last week about Mr. Terrence Dixon of Pennsylvania suing after being locked in the garage for 8 days, sustaining himself on Pepsi and dog food, and agreeing and winning $500,000 from the person he was trying to rob's homeowner insurance. January 2000, Kathleen Robertson of Austin, Texas, was awarded $780,000 by a jury of her peers after she broke her ankle tripping over a toddler who was running inside a furniture store. The owners of the store were understandably surprised at the verdict, considering that the misbehaving child was Ms. Robertson's own son. Who says that get-rich-quick schemes always fail? Today's program is going to feature our old friends Dr. Tony Held as well as Jerry Rose coming back to talk to us a little bit about adventures in eclipse chasing. But I feel like doing some current events because I got a bunch of stuff in front of me, and let's go through some of this. See, we commented last week on the calculation of pi to 1.24 trillion places. The B evidently thought this was worthy of commendation and published a small editorial saying, "Super computing job." I don't know. Remember that flap about the Intel chip a few years back when they calculated that it would round off its actual calculations to 7 decimal places? And someone pointed out that even at that level, 7 decimal places versus 8, it really had virtually no practical problems in the real world of engineering and calculations. So I guess I can agree with the B that it is a virtuoso feat that pushes the capacity of computing to new levels, but I still have to ask my question, why? And if we're going to question high-tech dubious enterprises, I think the one that probably should be first and foremost on our list is the SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative. President Bush has ordered the missile defensive system deployed. Erecting this thing is going to be the Pentagon's most expensive development program. It's likely to cost hundreds of billions of dollars. Yes, hundreds of billions of dollars over the coming decades. This in spite of the fact that the United States suffered its third straight failure out of 8 tests attempting to shoot down long-range dummy warheads in space over the Pacific Ocean. The scientific critics, of which there are many of this multi-million dollar boondoggle, have charged that it is not mature enough to begin deployment. But Bush and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld have stressed the need for such a defense against attack from, quote, rogue states, unquote, especially in the wake of devastating attacks on America using hijacked airliners. Now, how it is a missile defense shield operating above the stratosphere can offer citizens protection from box cutter wielding hijackers is something I'm a little unclear on. If you know the answer to that, why don't you give us send us an email at info@radioparallax.org. And speaking of Donald Rumsfeld, story off the AP wires. Rumsfeld denies U.S. hungry for war. Rejecting suggestions Thursday that the United States was eager for war with Iraq, Rumsfeld said U.S. officials intend to spend the next few weeks scrutinizing the weapons declaration compiled by Baghdad. Well, I guess the Pentagon's maybe looking for a new theme song, which, as far as we knew, was as follows.
Now this means war! Fredonia's gone to war! Each native son will grab a gun and run away to war!
At last we're going to war!
We go on the street to war!
At last the country's gone to war!
This is the country's gone to war!
At last the country's gone to war!
We're going to war!
This is a fact we can't ignore!
We're going to war! This is a fact we can't ignore! We're going to war!
Well, it appears that war is not in our immediate future, and let's hope it stays that way for a long, long time. Over in Vienna, Santa Claus is getting an icy reception from Austrians. There's a movement afoot that is crusading to bring back the traditional St. Nicholas and the Christ Child as the reason for the Christmas holiday. Signs are popping up showing like Santa Claus, at least the American version of him, with a red slash across the chest. Austrians are rejecting Santa Claus as an American symbol, someone that brings toys to American children while basically sweeping everyone up into a frenzy, American style of buying and commercial consumption at the expense of reflection upon celebrating people and the relationship to God. The opponents of Santa Claus claim, and I think probably with some justification, that the image we have on him is based heavily upon a Coca-Cola company promotion in the 1930s. If you notice that this traditional view we have of Santa Claus in America is that wearing red and white, very much the colors of Coca-Cola. You know, and there is a nativity scene right around the corner from my house that has a Santa Claus that clearly uses a cardboard cutout from a Coke promotion because Santa's hand appears to have formerly held a bottle of Coke, which has now been cut out of it. I'm not making this up. So I think there is something to this, and it'd be interesting to see where this goes. Here's a story I've been trying to get to for some weeks. This year, Marmite celebrates its 100th anniversary. Now, Marmite is not that familiar to most Americans. If you travel to the United Kingdom, you might be familiar with it. If you've traveled to Australia, you may know its closely related cousin, Vegemite. Both are made of a spreadable yeast extract. Marmite came first. It was originally manufactured as a byproduct of the brewing industry. They had all this yeast goo left over. They decided to basically put into bottles and sell. I mean, this stuff has some B vitamins in it, but you really have to try it to experience it. It's noted in this article I have from the Baltimore Sun that many people in England loathe it, being that it resembles spent motor oil in texture, appearance, and according to many, taste. I first heard about yeast extract when I was in Australia, and someone pointed out that, oh yeah, Vegemite, mate, great stuff. And the first story I heard about it was that in a college, which I believe was in Canberra somewhere, there were a bunch of hungry students who used to regularly raid the canteen and steal anything that, you know, any sort of food they'd get their hands on, with one exception. They would leave the Vegemite packets. Now, you know, if hungry college students won't consume this stuff, there must be a bit of a problem. So really, it's one of the great mysteries of the British Isles, perhaps the greatest mystery of the British Isles, even ahead of that of Stonehenge, as to how this stuff has survived for 100 years. I went on the website to look into this, and there was a big argument going on over which was better, Vegemite or Marmite. So I went out, in the interests of this radio program, and doing what I can to educate you, the listening public, and I bought a bottle of each. I tried it. And by my reckoning, Marmite is the better of the two spreads, although my sound engineer, my award-winning sound engineer, Edward McMillan, is partial to the Vegemite. Tony Held sided with him, so it's 2-1 on our informal survey as to which is better, but not that any of the three of us thought either was particularly good. But, you know, I don't know. I understand how in like World War I or World War II, when there was food shortages and people were doing what they can to sustain themselves, and you had to have something that, you know, you had to find something with nutrition in it, that you could use yeast extract in favor of something like peanut butter. I don't know. I'm dieting right now, and actually the Marmite and Vegemite have been a great help. A little bit of that on a cracker goes a long way toward curbing your appetite. All right, here's an even more whimsical story I've been waiting to insert into this show for some time. This was Dateline Calcutta, India, last March on the Reuters News Service. Headline, Man Gets Job Interview Call After 34 Years. Ravindra Nath Halder, 52, and a grandfather, was just a teenager when he put his name down for work at a state labor exchange office in Marxist-ruled West Bengal. Quote, I'd given up hope. I'd applied in 1968. I'm now 52 and too old for a government job, Halder, a father of two daughters and a son, told Reuters. Now, I have been to India and I have been to Calcutta specifically. I gotta say, I'm not that surprised by this story. Reuters apparently asked Labor Minister Mohammed Amin about this, and he said that it often, quote, takes a long time, unquote, for a person to be called for an interview. It turns out anyone older than 37 is ineligible for a job in the state government or its affiliated organizations. But the Halder family still hasn't abandoned hope. Halder's son put his name down at the exchange for a job 4 years ago, but has not yet been called. We're very pleased that we beat the national media to an interview with Trent Lott on Radio Parallax last week. The controversy has only increased around Senator Lott since then, and he now returns to our program to see if he can't further clear the air. Joining us now on the phone from Biloxi, Mississippi, is Senator Trent Lott. Senator, thanks for returning.
Well, I do seek to reach out to California. Well, with all those electoral votes at stake, I don't think I can work hard enough to clarify my position.
On the fact that you are not a racist.
The people over at Black Entertainment Television understand that I uphold the same image of black people that they do.
But it seems BET is always showing black people acting like gangsters, strumpets, and hip-hopping ne'er-do-wells.
And don't forget loafers, layabouts, and menacing thugs.
Just the sort of images that the KKK might be comfortable with.
If BET is comfortable with such, so am I. And may I say, I've obtained a distinguished African-American to help with my public relations.
Who?
Johnny Cochran. You know, his motto for me is, you like Strom? Well, that just ain't no prom.
Catchy.
Johnny's pointing out to community leaders that I've had many blacks on my staff, and I have for years.
Is that so?
Oh my, yes, there's Amos, my chauffeur. No better driver in the state of Mississippi. And if I need a quick shine, I don't need to run down to the corner for it. Amos will put a coat of black down faster than you can say Jackie Robinson. Jack Robinson. My janitorial staff has more colored faces than a minstrel show. They all fine workers, too. You can eat off the floor in my office.
Well, we'll pass.
And my maid Beulah? Well, I defy you to go to my office with white gloves and fine dust. Y'all can't do it.
What about the suggestions that you've resisted civil rights for blacks?
Look, in Old South, we used to ask the coloreds to help defray the cost of elections with a poll tax. It was well-meaning, but it was wrong. And them Jew lawyers that come down to Dixie to agitate over all that, well, I got to know some of them pretty good in law school. And we got along good.
You and the Jewish lawyers.
I learned to love how crafty they were. Cunning adversaries in a courtroom. They horse trade with the best of them. They natural bone bargainers, I'd say.
So you like the Jews?
Oh, the Chinamen, too. My neighborhood laundry, you should see the work they do. If a spot can be gotted out, by God, they do it. They're the most industrious little yellow people ever, except maybe the Japanese. Both are busy as bees. And I've always cared the Indian vote, by the way. I just toss a little firewater their way, and they're good pals. And speaking of liquor, the Irish and me get along fine.
Why is that?
Because they know. I'll pull them right out of the gutter, buy them some coffee to sober them up, and get them right back on the job site. I've been doing it for years. And I don't just mean with Senator Kennedy. I'm just kidding with that one. Ted and I are good friends. Sober or three sheets to the wind, I always enjoy Teddy.
Anybody else you feel the need to reassure us about?
Well, the Mexican has no better friend in the Senate than Trent Lott of Mississippi. Even though they're pulling across our border like lemons, I'm not worried over Mexicans taking our jobs. Both my gardener and cook folded the Rio Grande.
Mississippi has no border with Mexico, Senator.
Well, even if we did, I'd lose no sleep over them grabbing low-wage jobs. I approve of letting the Mexican wash our dishes and pick our fruit.
I'm sure they're glad to hear that.
And the heat don't faze them. For my money, they can outwork any white man or colored in the heat, which is odd because the slave was imported for his heat tolerance, you know. Africa's hotter than a pepper.
So, the Mexican outworks the American in the heat, you say?
I'd say pound for pound he does. Of course, they are bantamweights, usually.
Anyone else you'd care to mend fences with?
No, I've just about had my fill of racial harmony for one day.
Well, thank you, Senator.
One last thing about the Japanese. They build cars after doing calisthenics. Now, with all due respect, how are you going to get black folk or white or brown Americans to do jumping jacks before they tighten the lug nuts?
I don't know.
Well, that makes two of us. You know what? Those little yellow men are something. I think they can outdo robots. They're very zealous people.
Well, Senator Trent Lott, thank you very much for coming.
Incidentally, my Biloxi office got redecorated by a homosexual last year. They have style, what can I say? I'll use him again, too, next time. I'm very pleased with the work he done. I don't care if a fella's got a limp wrist or if he's a real he-man. How does the office look when he's done? You know, that's the question. That's what matters.
Spoken like a person from the party of Lincoln.
Now, why'd you have to go and spoil our discussion by mentioning that Yankee? We were doing so well.
Well, sorry. Thank you, Senator Lott. I like David Letterman's line about it and remember, you have only six more Trent Lott apology days until Christmas. Now, one story that really fascinates me, I think fascinates me more than anything else we've talked about to date, is this ossuary, this bone box coming out of Israel that has an inscription on it in the language of the Jewish people that was spoken during the time of Jesus, Aramaic. Now, there was only a very brief period in the history of Jews and Christians where Jewish people were, their remains were basically placed in these bone boxes. This is the time period that comes right after the time during which Jesus lived. So ossuaries are real things. This one apparently does date to approximately the right time period, as best anyone can tell. But the debate is raging as to whether it is what would in fact be the only relic with a direct archaeologic link to Jesus. Closer inspection of the inscription indicates to experts in the Holy Land that they're in two different hands. That the first part of it does say James, son of Joseph, but that the phrase brother of Jesus appears to have been added later. It was described as a, quote, poorly executed fake, unquote, by one religious authority. But the best I've been able to tell, that even people who are a little less skeptical have now concluded that it does appear that there are two different scripts on the ossuary and two different carvers, and that the second half may well have been written as late as 3 or 4 centuries after the original. Another strange story related to Jesus, which got perhaps even more publicity than the ossuary issue, was the fact that what would Jesus drive is the theme of a series of new anti-SUV television ads launched by the Evangelical Environmental Network, which is located, I guess, in Wynnewood, Pennsylvania. The campaign's part of a groundswell of opposition to sport utility vehicles. The Sacramento News and Review cited this in an editorial, noting that they were as surprised as many to see this ad campaign. But to quote from the News and Review, they said that no matter what your religious beliefs may be, we hope you accept the idea that we all have responsibilities to others and to promoting a healthy, peaceful world. The SUV, I don't know what Jesus would drive, but I do have to agree that the SUV is something that we could probably use a little bit less of in contemporary American society. And we're running out of time on our first segment here, but one final comment related to Jesus, and after all, this is the Christmas season, and it's all supposed to be about the celebration of the birth of Jesus of Nazareth. Popular Mechanics magazine headlined that they had the real face of Jesus inside their pages, using some rather bogus methods, I would say, of using some skulls, which date to approximately the time of Jesus, very close, that were dug up in Israel, in the area of Israel-Palestine. They basically morphed these together, and then using the methods of clay modeling, recreate the face to establish what this sort of composite a Jewish individual would have looked like. In front of me right now, this is a radio. I can't do adequate description, I think, of the face, although I will tell you it does look an awful lot like our Hollywood correspondent David Rosenblum. I don't know this how you could take three people, average them together, and say, well, Jesus might have looked like this. But the face that does stare back at me certainly does look like someone who would be expected to live in the area of Palestine. It is very strange that the picture that we have, probably the most common drawing that we have of Jesus, does not look like a Semitic person. He has almost sandy blonde hair, long nose, blue eyes. If you've been to that part of the world, I just got to say, I don't think that's really likely what he would have looked like physically. We, of course, have no physical descriptions whatsoever to tell us, to guide us as to what Jesus might have looked like. And anyway, it isn't about what he looked like. It's about his message. I guess I got to give Popular Mechanics some credit for trying. All right, well, we're just about out of time. There's so many topics I didn't get to, but, well, we've got next week's show, our Christmas show. But after the break, we will be rejoined by Dr. Tony Held. As always, we'll have interesting things to talk about, I think. You're listening to Radio Parallax. I am Douglas Everett.